Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, you'll hear audio recorded at the 2023 Advanced Therapies Week Conference, held in Miami, Florida, and focused on advancing cell and gene therapy. In a panel discussion moderated by Chris McLean, a senior vice president at Be the Match Biotherapies, experts examine challenges to conducting cell and gene therapy clinical trials and how to overcome them to expand access to care. Expert panelists include Dr. Heather Stefanski and Aaron LaCrone of NMDP Be the Match, as well as Gabby Giammarino of Moffitt Cancer Center. To read bios on the session moderator and panelists, and to access additional resources related to this panel discussion, click the link in the episode description. This is part two of a two-part episode.
But I would love to know, you know, from your perspective, and Aaron alluded to it a little bit, there's just some studies that are very complicated, they're difficult. You have financial aspects you raise, Gabby, that might make you say, I just don't feel like enrolling someone in this study. But the pushiness of sponsors, either through the CRO or directly, what are your thoughts on that? Is it effective? Does it bring their study to the top of your mind, and then you start enrolling, or are you thinking, I hate this sponsor?
I would say no, it doesn't encourage us at all. I definitely think that sometimes it even discourages us in a sense, because if you do try to recruit patients who, like she mentioned earlier, there are certain patients who do fit the study, and then there's certain ones who maybe aren't such a good choice, but those patients now come into that loop because you're so pressured to recruit all these people that it's not that perfect group of patients anymore. Now it does go out into that group of patients that may not be the best fit, but do meet eligibility, so let's go for it. And also, it kind of brings it to the point of, these are human beings, these are people. So we can't just go up to everybody we see and just try to get them to be on this clinical trial if it isn't the best for them long-term. And also if it's kind of just, I don't know, I just think the presentation of it just makes it a lot more pressure on us, but also I think that pressure is definitely conveyed into the communication that we give not only to the PIs that we work with, but especially the patients that we're trying to put on the trial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's follow on that with compensation levels. And this is an area that I hardly know anything about, but I can tell you that I'm old enough to know that at one point in time, there was a rule of thumb in oncology studies, Jim, you may know this data point too, that you could budget a study, an oncology study before cell therapy, and you could get a pretty good estimate, $75,000 a trial participant would be a good way to rule of thumb an oncology study. At one point, it was 50 at one point. Cell therapy is a different universe altogether, right? And this not only is it way more expensive, and the reimbursement regime is evolving as we go, so it's not a solid reimbursement regime. It's test stressing every aspect of the infrastructure. At least it was 5 years ago, right? This, I talked to people who are in a study environment, and it would be, you know, if I usually in an oncology study have three things I don't know about with this new approach. In cell therapy now, I've got like 20 different things. I'm not quite sure how to do it. I haven't done it before, I'm not sure how I'm going to handle it. You have to account for the costs of that, right, at Moffitt. And then I know from being on the sponsor side, we could have every rule of thumb in the world, but then we get our clinops people negotiating with the CRO, and they are negotiating every dollar of that budget. The rule of thumb goes out completely. It becomes this game almost where they hammer down the cost. So Gabby, going to you on this cost consideration, because I don't know much about it. I'd love to know this. But when you're implementing a cell therapy study, general cell therapy study at Moffitt, how much out of pocket is there that's being spent by the trial participants, and how much is ending up probably being covered by Moffitt because the budget that the sponsor agreed to with the CRO and the hospital is actually not costing everything? Do you have a Do you have a specific fear or even a gut feeling about it?
I would say that pretty much anything that would be considered the routine or standard of care will always be billed to the patient's insurance. The sponsors will majority of the time only cover those extra resources that are needed. However, they do have parameters to those. So although it is a standard of care, it may not happen within window. So now you're left with a situation where, okay, well, these things need to be reordered because, yes, they were done standard of care, but maybe not on the exact timeline. So then it comes to billing, and then that is one of those situations where that bill goes to the patient because insurance took over the first one and the sponsor never agreed to pay. So that we get into situations like that occasionally, which can be a little bit difficult, but I will say for majority of it does go through the patient's insurance or out of pocket.
Okay, and then does Moffitt end up, does the hospital end up covering some of these costs as well?
I do not believe so, no.
Okay, yeah. Aaron, on this topic of budgets, right, you and I have talked about budgets quite a bit, and rules of thumb. Do you have a rule of thumb for kind of for a cell therapy study, whether it be a transplant form of cell therapy or a T-cell therapy or any other type of cell therapy, for kind of what a budget really should be to run a cell therapy study?
Well, a lot of it's dependent on the protocol-specific aspects because we do like to use, you know, we need to look at fair market value for reimbursement to the transplant centers, which can depend on region. You know, if you're running a global clinical trial, you need to look at what are the right rates because you're really compensating for the time, like a lot of the labor. So the time for the consent, the time for the data collection and the data entry into the clinical study database. So it really is dependent on how much data and how much the clinical trial needs. Now, I will say I in the past couple of years, we have seen centers pushing back a lot harder. They'll put together their own worksheet of these are all of the costs that it's gonna take to run this clinical trial and holding a lot firmer to those costs to say like, well, we can't because we're gonna absorb these costs if you don't pay for this. So we have been seeing that pressure and that pushback probably also related to some of the, you know, the staffing costs to say we need another person, you know, for our clinical research department at the hospital. And if you don't compensate us for all of our labor associated with this trial, we can't get it, you know, then we're running deficits. So, you know, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a rule of thumb. You know, certainly, you know, academic studies where there's just like, this is what the grant's going to cover, take it or leave it. They're, you know, transplant centers are less likely to try to negotiate there, but with sponsor corporate studies, there is the desire now to cover all the costs.
Okay. And Heather, you may not remember, but one of the earliest conversations you and I ever had to do with budgets for how much it costs to administer a cell therapy at Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And there's the direct cost that we tend to pay attention to the drug cost. That gets a lot of publicity, the Kymriah drug cost, you know, and then Bluebird upping the ante with its proposed multi-million dollar pricing for its drug. But the fact of the matter is that even in transplant, these are very really expensive therapies. If you add in all of the hospitalization costs, you add in the lab costs and all that, we're talking about $1 million, right, for the cell therapies. And so from your perspective, now, sort of going into the future here, so in my mind, that makes the rule of thumb. If I had to peg a rule of thumb for an oncology study that's a cell therapy, and I wanted to be true to what I'm hearing about budgets, I'm thinking it's like $1 million a patient. I think it's possible that if we added up all the costs, it could reach that level. I don't know if the study budgets ever get there, but taking a look at the future, I'd like to talk about how do we reduce that cost. Are there ways, when you were working at Minnesota and you were administering these therapies, you were thinking to yourself, we could cut a lot of costs out of this by doing the following things? And can any of those things be applied to clinical studies to reduce the cost of the studies?
So I would say, like, when you're thinking about all the labs that you get, you know, can you do it outpatient? That totally decreases the cost. And the problem with Medicare was that we haven't been able to do a lot of outpatient procedures because if you get something and then you're in the hospital, or they would want to do a hospitalization, but then if you get rehospitalized within 72 hours, they don't pay the bill, which is a ridiculous rule, right? But then that precludes you from doing the right thing or trying to decrease the costs. And I was on a lot of conversations actually with Blue Cross Blue Shield trying to make them understand that piece, and I don't think they still do. But neither do other insurance companies. So really thinking about decreasing the labs, doing it outpatient, making it safer so patients can get outpatient faster, not seeing them every day in clinic. Like, just because you've always done that doesn't mean you always have to do that, right? Like, transplant is getting safer. Like, I think about when I started, you know, we didn't have all of the antiviral drugs. Patients were dying of adenovirus all the time. And now we have cidofovir and some other, you know, like, we have CTLs that can help with that. And so, like, trying to reduce it that way, looking at medicine, you know, post-transplant site, you know, cyclophosphamide, right? Like, maybe then we don't have to keep patients on anti-GVHD prophylaxis for as long. And so there's different ways that will evolve, but it is expensive. And I think as we get more cell therapies, that they're going to decrease the costs, right? Like, it's never going to, the ecosystem isn't going to survive. And I also think that we're going to have to think about it in a different way, because now, you know, people change jobs a lot more, right? They get new insurances, and insurance companies, you know, they're, what if Kymriah, like, let's say it only works for 6 months, and in that time you have changed the insurance company, and now you're going to need another cell therapy. So I think that the companies and the insurance companies are going to have to come together, and the companies are going to have to say, like, we believe in this product, it should work, you know, this much of the time, or whatever it is. Same with gene therapy, right? How do you know 5 years from now that gene therapy is still going to be working? And that was $3.5 million, which doesn't even include all of the other costs. And so I think it's going to be a different model, right? Like, it's going to be, okay, you're going to be with us, I'm going to pay for 20% of this, and then your next insurance company is going to have to pay for part of that. If that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And this, you know, this is where I think the field had a moment, and when it came to pricing, where we were excited about you know, pay for performance basically on the drugs, right? But then we started talking about how would this actually be implemented when someone changed insurance companies, which we do as a society here in the United States, like every 4 years or something, right?
Yes.
We're changing jobs, we're changing insurance companies, and we again, if we're honest with ourselves, we would admit the number of cancers that can be cured with one drug right now can be counted on one hand. Mm-hmm. It's always a combination, right? It's combinations and series of combinations to extend life is what we're looking at. The new therapies are super exciting. They're incredibly expensive. If we're just adding those in for another 6 months, like you said, and then we're doing more and more combinations of them, I think we'll break the system, right?
Yes.
It won't be sustainable. All right, so Aaron, on this topic of and Gabby, okay, and actually all three of you, I think this is an interesting topic. So we talked about toxicities in cell therapies, and of course there's been a lot of buzz around NK cell therapies. And one of the you know, major excitements about NK cell therapies is a possible reduction of some of these toxicities and the ability to multi-dose, right, and not kill the patient by doing it. Recently, we've seen, you know, some companies pulling back out of the NK cell field. Fate, with its big announcement at the first day of JP Morgan, was a drag, to say the least. I think everyone was hoping they were going to come out with good clinical data. Instead, they terminated six of the programs. So the reason I bring it up is, Gabby, I'll go to you on this. Are there certain new technologies that you at Moffitt are getting exposed to and you're talking about, and to you as a healthcare, you know, someone that at the point of care are thinking, these are the therapies we like. This is the technology that we think is going to be the one or the type that is going to revolutionize the way we treat these cancers. So what we hear in our world is what the sponsors say. And the sponsors, of course, are out there promoting their own approaches, right? I do an iPS-derived CAR NK cell. That, of course, is the most exciting possibility for the future. But you would know, right? I'm curious, is there anything in the clinical study environment that you're seeing where you think this is a very good combination of affordability, efficacy, and safety?
I wouldn't say there's one exact therapy, but I think they each kind of bring something to the table. So I think if we get to a point where we can kind of combine the Similar to how Heather's mentioned earlier, how the cost, eventually we're going to have to bring that down. So I think it's just unfortunate that some of the trials are exponentially higher in cost than others. However, they might be more effective as what we're seeing now. So I think it's just kind of not so much that one is more beneficial than the other. I think the more successful ones have more resources. And I think maybe if we were able to kind of even that out a little bit, it would give each trial the opportunity to thrive. I just think that there are certain therapies that kind of get more funding and more attention, which while they may be bringing great results, that's fantastic. But I think to kind of explore it in a broad area would be beneficial in the end for all. So,
yeah, one of the categories of therapy that you know raised like literally breathtaking amounts of money, allogeneic therapies, right? Starting 3 or 4 years ago, $800 million Series A raises by the platform companies, literally breathtaking amounts, you know, 10 times what the other modalities were raising. If, you know, if our sampling of clients is accurate, those are actually the companies that are having the hardest time enrolling studies right now are the allotherapies. And I want to go to you, Heather, and then Aaron on this topic. So allogeneic therapies, this would be a category of therapy that when I asked Gabby that question a few years ago, you might have said, well, I've been hearing there's these off-the-shelf allotherapies. That's an exciting future. We all hope it's a really exciting future. Is it an exciting future, Heather, by your estimation as a physician, or how far do we have to go? How many more years do you think we have? We've got approved autologous therapies that are working. We're getting better at managing them, which sounds like we're getting better at picking patients.
Yeah.
Are the allogeneic therapies going to be part of the mix in 3 years, in 5 years? Is it 10 years? What's your guess here?
3 years.
Okay.
And I think when I look back, you know, the problem with autologous therapies is they rely on whatever the patient's makeup is. And whatever's in their body at that time, which frankly probably isn't the best time to collect them, we should be collecting them a lot earlier and storing a product. And then saying, you know, like for high-risk patients, this is my personal view, not be the matches, this is my personal view as a physician, that, you know, if I could have collected my patients that relapsed with leukemia right away and stored their product, that would have been way better. Because by that time that I'm actually collecting them, they have horrible T cells. And then I'm going to make a product with that, you know? And so that's the problem with autologous therapies. We don't have, it's whatever's in the patient. Allogeneic, it's an off-the-shelf product. Will it be an NK cell? Will it be a CAR T? Will it be something else? I don't know what's going to be the best. I think there's going to be different ones. But I do think it would be really nice to get away from the patient. And then it can be cheaper, right?
And 3 years is encouraging, right?
Yeah,
that's an encouraging number.
Yeah.
So, Aaron, let's go to you on this topic of allogeneic therapy. So, of course, you're running a lot of transplant studies. That is an allogeneic therapy, but it's a one-to-one allogeneic therapy as opposed to an off-the-shelf therapy. I don't know if you have any experience yet running a study with an off-the-shelf allogeneic therapy, but as you look to that future, which is, I would assume, a likely future of the type of therapy that would eventually start running through your CRO as you open it up to corporate clients, is there anything that sort of comes to mind in terms of that study design that you are particularly concerned about or excited about? Anything you want, any thoughts you want to share at all on that type of therapy?
You know, I will just say I've been seeing in some of the trials that we've doing are just some, you know, seems like talk in the space right now that for auto trials, maybe CAR trials, that, you know, you're not seeing maybe the results that you want. There is a lot more conversation about adding allo arms to see if that could potentially be, you know, be a solution. So if you're getting to a certain dose level for the CAR studies and not seeing, you know, seeing the results you want. So I think in that way, it seems like there is a, you know, a movement back to allo, where once we're to Heather's point, once we thought like auto might be the solution. You know, I think, you know, I'm kind of excited from this space because, you know, logistically it just makes things easier in clinical trials. You know, these trials in the space are about the most highly complex. I mean, coming from a different industry, when I first came into this space, I just was like, wow, this is a the people who are running these trials have a lot to think about and a lot to move through. So I think being able to kind of ease the burden on some of the logistics, and I mean, you know this very well, Chris, you know, from your running, you know, working in biotherapies in that space, just with some of the clients are, you know, running into with logistics, and be able to find solutions there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Unbelievably complicated. So many potential failure points in the supply chain. Lots of smart people working on it. So it's getting better, including us, right?
Yeah.
We are getting better at it. But the future, the prospective future with an off-the-shelf therapy, of course, really, really enticing, right? Mm-hmm. It makes sense to have a cell therapy that's prescribed in the similar fashion that a pharmaceutical is or a biologic is today. Absolutely, really, really, yeah. I think we need to get there. It's just a question of timing. So we got, I don't know, what time is it? We've got 5 minutes till the top of the hour. I might throw it out there and see if anyone has any questions. If you don't have any questions, I've got some questions. But I do want to open it up to the audience.
Can I just make one more comment? Is when I look back with our clinical trials and thinking about sponsors, the most frustrating thing for us as a university was all of the amendments that the sponsor would do to their clinical trial. And, you know, it'd be like we just got through the IRB and now you're sending us another amendment. And so that's why taking truly when you're thinking about making a clinical trial, making it as simple as possible and figuring out what do you really need, you know, because then it's all of that is time, you know, and then you're not getting paid for that. Right. I mean, it depends on how smart you were with the contract. We got a lot smarter, you know, as time went on, because it's like all of those amendments, you have to change the consent forms. You have to change so many things that go along with it. So in thinking about it, just remember, nobody likes amendments.
Yeah.
It also goes to the difficult sponsor, the difficult CRO,
yes.
Like trying to push through these amendments. So I think I agree. It's like the trust. You have to. I think really the success of a clinical trial does depend a little bit on the trust you're able to establish with the transplant centers that you will make good decisions, you will be careful with their time.
And I feel like sponsors, you know, if they find something wrong, they immediately want to do an amendment as opposed to saying, okay, we're having a continuing review, this can wait until that time. And we would try to push back on that, but they never agreed with that. So, anyway.
Thank you for raising that. No, that's important. Thank you for that. We've got so a couple minutes. Anyone have any questions? Otherwise, I'll throw one out to the panel.
Well, Jim.
Yes.
First of all, some really good points you all have made, so thank you, especially around costs and things, standard of care. So with non-hemonc therapies, I'm just curious if you have any comments from the site perspective on what you've had to implement to make that successful.
Yeah, we...
So, like non-hemonc, like solid tumor sorts of therapies, or?
No, so non-malignant.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, like gene therapy. Is that what you mean?
Well, or cellular therapies that are for neurodegenerative disorders,
oh.
Or things where you have to collaborate within the institution with staff
no,
or
I understand.
Units that are not as familiar with administering cell therapy.
So I don't have a lot of experience with that, but I do know that at my old institution, there was definitely, you know, a push-pull where if all of a sudden, you know, we're doing a cell therapy for MS and the neurologist is going to be in charge of that, we would not have felt comfortable with that because none of their staff had ever seen what that would do. And we would have, you know, at this time, I still think that it would have to be on a floor where cell therapy is done, but it's definitely a push-pull then because who is going to get the revenue for that, right? But if you don't have the expertise, it's a real problem. And I even think about when we implemented Kymriah, when it became commercialized. Like at that time, the pharmacist didn't know what to do with the product, right? Because it's not a cell, it's a cell therapy, but it's a drug. And so we actually had to come up with an entire new process on how to label that as a drug. And that took like 6 months. And so I think in these places that aren't as in tune with that cell therapy, you really need to have good collaboration with someone that knows, with the program or the division that knows how to do that.
I would probably add on to that and say I would encourage you to run through some patient profiles or patient flows for what that collaboration among departments might have to look like. Maybe solicit some, you know, input from some of the transplant centers you may be going with. We have a trial right now that we're in the process of starting up, or well, it's about to start up, that's for aplastic anemia, that's randomizing transplant against immunotherapy. And this is one where there has to be a collaboration among departments to actually do like dual consenting, because you're not sure, you know, prior to the randomization. So, you know, I think going through the, taking the time to set up the protocol and go through those workflows from the transplant or from the center perspective is really valuable to try to weed out those missteps and, you know, possible complications.
And then just one other point about that is then also then looking at it from the patient perspective, right? Because they want to, and they're going to be the ones enrolling on that clinical trial, and you want to make it as seamless for them as possible and not have department politics like come across, I would say. And, you know, it's all about communication. Everything's about communication. I truly believe you can't overly communicate, because something will always get missed if you don't. And no detail is too small, is what I would say.
Gabby, do you have anything you want to add to this topic that Jim brought up of sort of multi-unit studies or cross-department studies?
Yeah, I think just communication, and especially early communication, is the most vital portion of that. Especially working in such complex facilities, there are many different ancillary departments that get looped in, not even just the two main that would be involved. There's also, you know, the inpatient nursing staff, there's the pharmacist, there's the financial department, and of course the coordinators. There's just so many other ancillary departments that also need to be looped in, the radiology team. So I think just the earlier you can get that communication kind of sorted out and a plan implemented to kind of do that, I think the first patient, of course, might be a little bit difficult, but I think after that it could, with positive communication and definitely a lot of it, I think that would be the key to being successful in that situation.
That's a really good question, though, because that is going to come up. We've definitely seen it with different types of therapy.
Yep. Thank you, Jim, for asking the question. Thank you to the panelists for answering it and for participating over the course of the last hour roughly. I think we're gonna call it an evening at 6 o'clock. Thank you to the hearty souls that showed up at 5 o'clock to join us, and we'll enjoy everyone. I'm sure will enjoy an evening out tonight. Thank you again, panelists, for making this all happen.
Being a great moderator.
Oh, happy to do it. Happy to do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. For more information and to access research and resources related to this episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. Until next time on Explore Cell Therapy.